The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Great to be with you. Last program of the work week. Hard to believe. Another fast-moving week here at our headquarters campus in Edmond, Oklahoma. Last night, we had our final rehearsal for Celtic Throne before the premiere event on Sunday afternoon. I know some members will be logging on to view that, I believe, this Sunday. And then, of course, the following Sunday, it opens up to anyone, as you can see there. If you've visited the Trumpet.com website recently, there is the live video event for July 5th, also Sunday afternoon. I think that's 2 p.m. here in Edmond. So if you haven't yet signed up for that, you still have plenty of time to do that. And we'll remind you of that next week as well. But last night, the event just keeps getting better and better as they're working hard right up to the last minute to make sure all the lighting is operating just the way that we want for it to. And they're still working on some of the transitions here and there. And I think my son's doing some last minute choreography here and there as well. But for the most part, we had about 100 people watching the rehearsal last night. And it was very well received, just like it was on Tuesday night. So it's the kind of show that you really want to see more than once because there's just so much packed into about an hour and a half. It's a relatively short show as well. So if you get the chance to see it more than once, you'll be glad that you did. It brought to mind the prophecy, or rather the Psalm 149, where it talks about praising God in dance and in singing. And we've heard a lot about this over the years. My father has some really inspiring sections in the Former Prophets book about God's educational system and all that we can do, even with music, to serve and to worship God. And this church, of course, has produced, I don't even know how many musicals we've produced and shows that we've produced and recitals and things of that nature, dozens and dozens over the years, and they just keep getting better and better. My father had an article in the Royal Vision just recently, how the new throne changes God's work. He gave a message on this just about a year ago. And it appeared recently in the Royal Vision, as I say. He talks about King David in this article. He references 2 Samuel 6 and verse 14, where David was described there as dancing enthusiastically. David danced before the Eternal with all his might. He danced with all of his might. He just put his whole heart into it. That's the way David did everything. And we saw that kind of enthusiasm last night. It says, even, this is my father writing, even in music and dance, David honored God. That is royal dancing and royal music. Even in music and dance, he honored God. He praised God. And as my father goes on to explain in that article, this is something that our young people today are learning. They're learning these kinds of skills. They're learning how to serve God, to honor God in dance, in music. That's another exciting feature to this show. I look forward to the rehearsals just so that I can hear the music again. We don't yet have all of the, I guess somebody must have the music on their laptop here. But I don't have all of the selections yet. We're going to be making a CD and a DVD and all those things here in the next few weeks. But I like going back just so that I can hear the music. And, of course, it's booming in Armstrong Auditorium. Really an inspiring scene. Hopefully you'll get a chance next week and beyond to see it. And if at all possible, if you can see it live it's, as I said yesterday, I think, it's something that a video really can't fully capture. So the live experience is incredible. Yesterday, I played some of those selections from the United States National Anthem and got quite a few emails in response to that. I think quite a few people were moved, in some cases moved to tears, to just see, to just compare a time, to compare the United States today to just a few years ago when the national anthem and when Old Glory really brought the nation together. This is from one of our listeners in Cyprus. He says, as a young boy in the 1950s in Australia, I grew up in a time of great hope. One of my teachers often started class with hymn singing while he accompanied us on his trumpet. He often disciplined me with the cane, it says, but I knew even then that it was because he loved me. At that school, we had marching drill when the whole school would march to military big brass music. It says it was a time of great hope. Some years later, at another school, we would raise the Australian flag in the morning and sing the Australian anthem. This is just something that was routine years ago to celebrate your nation's history, to celebrate your nation's anthem. Another listener from Florida says, thank you for today's broadcast. Back in the 1950s in elementary school, I was taught about the national anthem and Francis Scott Key, who observed the Battle of Fort McHenry in 1812 being bombarded by British ships. He was there watching it with some of his friends. He saw the American flag during the battle, and it was still there after the battle. He wrote about it, and later it became our national anthem. So that anthem has a history of an event that took place early in our nation's history. Too bad that it's not taught in schools today. In the 50s and 60s in schools, we said the Pledge of Allegiance to the standing in our hand to the flag, standing with our hands on our hearts each day. Also, we said a prayer, and at times we read scripture from the Bible at the beginning of the day. This is in school, public school. What a shame that it is no longer being done. We have come so far from God and loyalty to this nation. He says, finally, we're surely in the last days, and the Bible is coming true and alive before our eyes. Another listener here from Oklahoma, it says, thank you for the moving program yesterday. I'm not a person that easily tears up at patriotism, but seeing the former respect for the American flag and our national anthem brought tears with each clip. What a wonderful symbol America was for the world. All Americans should be deeply thankful for the blessings God bestowed on this nation. And every American should now do some personal examination as to why America is falling apart at the seams. It says, as your father has said in his recent program on President Lincoln, we have forsaken God. We have forsaken God. A couple more here. One says, I've been watching your YouTube stream for a few years, usually while I cook breakfast, or if I'm at work, I have it playing through my headphones. But this latest stream, I was watching while cooking, and I couldn't help but lose quite a few tears while the national anthem played at the Olympics, and they carried the damaged flag out. It's something else when they sing, our flag was still there. It's sad to see where we are right now and how far we have come apart, and to know that it's only going to get much, much worse. But it is a blessing to know where it all leads. Yes, indeed, it's a blessing to know where this leads. And then one final one here from North Dakota. One of our listeners says, powerful and very moving program today. It generated tears, tears of joy and pride during the clips, showing the love and pride for our flag and national anthem. Tears of sorrow while watching and hearing the hatred displayed via news outlets for those same symbols. The things that we see happening today tear at the heart and should drive all of us to our knees, beseeching the Almighty to send His Son soon to end all the horror. She says, I cry for the children I cry for the children. Finally, it appears that the real noose is the one that's gripping our nation, strangling the life out of courage, common sense, justice, and national pride. What a colossal tragedy we're witnessing. Thank God we know there is an end in sight to all the insanity that permeates the world today. And thank God also for the hope and understanding he gives anyone willing to listen to his warning message delivered by his faithful people. She says, let freedom ring. So some great comments in response to the program yesterday. Hopefully you, wherever you were, you had no trouble seeing it. I know YouTube flagged those clips because of copyright, they said, in some regions. But from what we can tell, they didn't pull the video down. So we're grateful for that. And just glad that most of you were able to see it. Well, speaking of yesterday's program, we played that clip from the Black Lives Matter leader. I think he's from New York City, where he's basically calling for violence. He's out on national TV saying how violence works. He's basically threatening the government, threatening America. If you don't give us what we want, we're going to burn down the system. President Trump's response to that, this was in a tweet yesterday. He's quoting this leader of the movement in New York, says, if U.S. doesn't give us what we want, then we'll burn down the system and replace it. And the president said, this is treason, sedition, insurrection. And of course, he's right about that. But like I noted yesterday, you can say that on national TV and it'll actually further your career in this climate that we're in. I've pointed out the contrast between individuals that say things such as that and other ones that fly a banner for 60 seconds. There's a story out of San Diego yesterday. This guy following somebody that worked for the electricity department in San Diego, and he took a picture of him with his hand outside the window. I guess the signal is A-OK, but evidently that's also in some circles a white power symbol. So he got a snapshot of the guy's hand hanging outside of his truck. He's just doing his job in San Diego. And of course he gets fired. He gets fired because the picture goes viral. This is what this guy did. And the incredible thing about this man who's worked for, I forget, I can pull it up here. It's the San Diego SDG&E worker fired over alleged racist gesture. And he's Hispanic. So his hand's hanging outside his truck. And he gets fired for flashing, supposedly, a white power sign. That can also mean A-OK. So he can't just carry on with his job without losing his job because of the mob on social media. Meanwhile, Black Lives Matter gets on Fox News and says, if you don't give us what we want, we're going to burn down your cities. We're going to burn down the system. And those people are seen as heroes. Well, they're civil rights heroes. They're just seeking justice for George. All the violence, you heard it at the top of the hour if you listen to the news. What's still happening in London? Police coming under attack. I saw a clip yesterday or the day before. These thugs just smashing to pieces a police vehicle. That was in southern London. And so the president tweets out, this is treason. And of course, it's his tweet that's controversial. It's his tweet. There was an article that turned up yesterday written by, I think it was actually a letter submitted to a college publication back in, I believe, 1995. And it happens to be from Nicole Hannah-Jones. She's the author, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the 1619 Project. this is the woman that essentially is writing the history curriculum for schools all over the United States of America. Thousands and thousands of schools are picking up the 1619 Project. And this article she wrote 25 years ago, it's revealing. It reveals a lot about her thinking. And she, as I say, she is celebrated today. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner. The Federalist is commenting on this article that turned up. It says, Nicole Hannah Jones, the lead essayist on New York Times Magazine's 1619 Project, wrote a letter to the editor in Notre Dame's The Observer back in 1995, stating that the white race is the biggest murderer, rapist, pillager, and thief of our modern world. All the problems in the world today, all the problems in the United States today, it all traces back to the whites. Says Hannah Jones claimed that the actions of European settlers and explorers such as Christopher Columbus were acts of devils and likens them to Hitler. It's like Hitler. You can see why the statues of Columbus are coming down. You can see why they're going to have to change the name Columbus at schools and wherever else. Thomas Jefferson, of course, President Trump, he was right on it 3 years ago. And he was mocked for that 3 years ago when he said, look, what happens after Robert E. Lee? Going to come after Thomas Jefferson and George Washington? No, come on, said Jim Acosta. That'll never happen. And we're just 3 years on. This article on this piece front. And keep in mind, this is the deranged racist that is responsible for developing the history curriculum. Possibly for your children. It says here, the whites' lasting monument was the destruction and enslavement of two races of people, Hannah Jones wrote. She claims Africans arrived in North America long before Europeans, but that unlike Europeans, Africans befriended and traded with the indigenous people. She claims pyramids in Mexico are a symbol of said friendship. So they came over peaceably, just wanted to make friends with people, and then those dirty Europeans came over. All the Hitlers of the European continent, like Columbus. It says here, she then moves to the present and argues that white people today still take advantage of other people. And this quotes her from 1995. The descendants of those savage people, that's the whites, pump drugs and guns into the black community, pack black people together in squalor, the squalor of segregated urban ghettos, and continue to be bloodsuckers in our community. So all the problems in the black community today, can be blamed on the whites as well. It's the whites pumping those communities full of drugs and guns, and then squeezing them all together. That's what the whites have done. She says, this is the distinguished author of the 1619 Project. She ends her letter by pitying the author she was responding to and claiming that white people still struggle with a supremacy complex. Says, but after everything that those barbaric devils did, this is quoting her letter from 1995, I do not hate them, she wrote. I understand that because of some lacking, they need to constantly prove their superiority. She's trying to explain these barbaric devils that are white people. So she's the one that earlier this year she won the Pulitzer Prize. She's developed this project that basically says the original sin of the United States, it started in 1619. And every problem that we've seen ever since can be traced back to that. The sin of slavery. There was an interesting interview with the Black Entertainment Television founder. His name is Robert Johnson. And he just commented on the riots, the violence sweeping across the cities of the United States. And he basically said that these people are borderline anarchists. So he's in the black community. He's black. And that's the thing about what that Black Lives Matter individual said on Fox News earlier this week, or what Hannah Jones says. There's quite a few people in the black community, even in the black community, that don't agree with these radicals, these Marxists, these communist infiltrators. And this BET founder, Robert Johnson, he's calling these rioters anarchists. And he's right. He's right. And he talks about the white people that are out front tearing down these statues. And in his view, he says, you know, people in my community, the black community, they're laughing at that. This isn't like this. They're laughing at this kind of cowardice, at this kind of weakness, at this kind of sickness. You see these clips of these white people shouting down policemen, even when the police are black. I saw one yesterday, the end of the clip, the police officer, he basically turned to the Bible and said, look, the problems in the United States, they trace back to sin. He was spot on. He was right. But these white liberals, these self-loathing whites, they're out there in so many cases. They're the ones out pulling down the statues, thinking that that's going to make the black community love us. And at least this BET founder says, I think they're just really laughing at you. Now, there's blacks in those mobs as well, but I think there was a stat Richard gave to me today. 46% of the protesters, the Black Lives Matter protesters, are white. He noted that 1/6 of the protesters are black. So there's obviously a mixture of all kinds of races. It's not even a matter of race, as I've been saying. This is a Marxist uprising. You can read through the Black Lives Matter mission statement. Go right to their website. And to think that this movement, it really has a stranglehold on the Democrat Party. It like that listener pointed out, that's the strangle. That's the noose. That's sickening the United States. That's the stranglehold on the Democrat Party. Nancy Pelosi, I didn't play this clip yesterday. I should have. I have it here. But she said in an interview earlier this week that the Republicans are guilty of murder. The murder, she even specifically said the murder of George Floyd. They've been arguing back and forth, the Democrats and the Republicans, over this police reform bill. And keep in mind, none of this ever came forward when Barack Obama and Joe Biden were in office. So following the George Floyd tragedy, here comes this bill, and the Republicans put it forward, and the Democrats say, well, it doesn't go far enough. We really want to handcuff the police. So they're calling for some kind of compromise, which for Democrats, that means they want the other side to just surrender. Take a knee, so to speak. Here's what Speaker Pelosi said in this interview. I think it's with a CBS reporter earlier this week, clip one.
For something to happen, they're going to have to face the realities of police brutality, the realities of the need for justice in policing, and the recognition that there are many, many good people in law enforcement, but not all, and that we have to address those concerns. So when they admit that and have some suggestions that are worthy of consideration, but so far they were trying to get away with murder, actually, the murder of George Floyd.
She says Republicans were trying to get away with murder, the murder of George Floyd, and Republicans were understandably outraged when she said this and demanded that she apologize. And she says, I'm not going to apologize at all. And Chuck Schumer steps forward and defends her. I don't see anything wrong with her statement. I think the Republicans have murdered George Floyd. Taking that tragedy, they have politicized everything. Everything is political. She can say that, no problem. That, like I say, that advances her career. That makes her more popular with the mob. And here's the Black Lives I played this yesterday. Here's the leader of the New York wing of the Black Lives Matter movement. And it's what he said on Fox just 2 days ago, clip two.
If this country doesn't give us what we want, then we will burn down this system and replace it. Think about the last few weeks. Since we started protesting, there have been 8 cops fired across the country. You remember they were telling us that there was due process. That's why the cop that choked Eric Garner to death had kept his job and received raises for 5 years. Anytime a cop hurt a woman, hurt a child, hurt pregnant people, hurt our elders, there was always a call for due process. You must wait. You must wait. But the moment people start destroying property, now cops can be fired automatically. What is this country rewarding? What behavior is it listening to? Obviously not marching.
Not listening to the marchers, not listening to peaceful protesters, so we've gotta be violent. We've gotta burn down cities. We've gotta smash up shops. We've gotta attack the police. Now, the few that would come forward and say, hey, you're inciting violence. His response to that is, this country, the United States, was built on violence. That's the 1619 Project. Howard Zinn would be proud. Speaking of self-loathing white liberals, he would be proud. The people's history of the United States of America. We've got to delete our history and replace it with the 1619 Project. This country was built on violence, so what's the big deal? What was it? Someone at CNN that compared it to the U.S. Revolution? What was happening in the streets a few weeks ago? These are people that are completely unhinged and can say anything that they want. And they're promoted if they do. Here's the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee yesterday, Gerald Nadler, saying that Antifa was, well, not really Antifa. Clip 9.
Dealing with imaginary things like Antifa.
Speech on the House floor. The chairman of the Judiciary Committee calling Antifa imaginary. It doesn't really even exist. It's just imaginary. Here he is. Here he is, one of the leading Democrats. You heard from Pelosi. One of the leading Democrats out there apologizing for the terrorists, for the domestic terrorists that want to destroy the country. At least Jim Jordan. He's a Republican. He got up in the same forum and criticized what Mr. Nadler had said. This was Jim Jordan's response. Clip 10.
I mean, I can't believe the chairman of the Judiciary Committee would utter such a statement on the House floor. But he said imaginary things like Antifa. They're not imaginary. They're real. And if you don't believe me, go talk to Portland, the journalist, Andy Ngo, and the journalist in Portland who was attacked by Antifa, who the president of the United States designated as a terrorist organization, and to have the chair of the Judiciary Committee on the House floor say this sentence, imaginary things like, or these words, not a sentence, imaginary things like Antifa, they are far from imaginary. And there are people in every major city in this country who know that, and yet the chair of the Judiciary Committee just made that statement. That is scary.
It is scary. That is scary. These are people creating... Speaking of imaginary, they're living in this imaginary world where Donald Trump is Hitler, where Donald Trump needs to be impeached. Nadler, by the way, says that Bill Barr needs to be impeached. Everybody on the other side needs to be impeached, thrown out of office. If they just let their hand hang outside their truck, they might be a racist. Who's going to stand up to the mob? Well, you heard the president's tweet. I read it for you earlier. Tweeting out, this is treasonous, what he's saying. If you don't give us what we want, we're going to burn down your cities? We're going to burn down the system? That's treason. And then yesterday, actually this might have been just this morning, all over the news, now that the riots have simmered down a bit, it's the second wave. The second wave of COVID-19. All of these new cases, millions and millions of cases. And they're happening in red states. The red states are the problem because they've opened up too soon. They've lifted the lockdown. It was as if COVID-19 didn't even exist for 2 or 3 weeks. When people all over the north, the deep, dark blue cities were violating every possible social distancing measure so that they could get out and loot and destroy. And now we're back to coronavirus. And here again is President Trump just trying to present the truth. Coronavirus deaths are way down. This is his tweet. Show that graphic if you guys have it. This is the graph of the daily deaths of coronavirus. You can see where it was peaking in the middle part of April. And here we are near the end of June. Just look at the graph. Look at the deaths. The daily deaths. It just keeps going down. And this is what the president's trying to point out. Well, we are in the midst of more testing. And hospitals are now back to normal in many cases. And so if you're coming into a hospital, you're going to be tested. They're saying something like 20 million people have probably tested positive for this. It is contagious. It has spread, and it's spread across the nation. But the curve, you can see the graphic yourself. If you're watching the stream on YouTube, the curve has been flattened. And so he points out in his tweet, deaths are way down. Mortality rate is one of the lowest in the world. Our economy is roaring back and will not be shut down. The president said embers or flare-ups will be put out as necessary. So it'll be dealt with in an isolated way. Case by case. But no, the media, they want for you to believe that this is just, it's spreading again like wildfire. We're done reporting on the riots. Now it's back to COVID-19. Now we really need to go back to a total lockdown. And you could really feel the momentum for this narrative building last week ahead of the rally that the president had in Tulsa. There's an agenda. Everything's politicized. That's what you have to keep in mind. So who do we bring forward? If we want to talk about what they're doing in Florida or Texas or maybe even here in Oklahoma, who do we bring forward to denounce what they're doing, lifting the lockdown? Who do we bring forward to say this is something that should not be done? We're jumping the gun here. Well, of course, you bring forward Governor Cuomo from New York. The state that's had the most coronavirus deaths by far. I mean, we're talking 10 times worse in many cases. Perhaps the worst, New York City, the worst hotspot in the world for COVID-19 deaths. And so the media, well, yeah, they're going to trot out Governor Cuomo to criticize Ron DeSantis in Florida. Governor Abbott in Texas. Here's Governor Cuomo yesterday, clip 3.
I quarantined them in March, and everyone, New York media, was blowing a gasket. How could you do this? That was the right decision. That was the number one landing pad. Had we not done the quarantine, you would have had way more cases, hospitalizations, the whole nine yards. I have no doubt that that quarantine saved lives.
So, what do you say to him today, now that the tables have turned?
Oh, I say to them all, look at the numbers. You played politics with this virus and you lost. You told the people of your state and you told the people of this country, White House, don't worry about it. Just open up, go about your business. This is all Democratic hyperbole. Oh, really? Now you see 27 states with the numbers going up. You see the death projections going up. You see the economy going down. It was never politics. It was always science. And they were in denial. And denial is not a life strategy.
That's Governor Cuomo responding. Obviously, I should have set that clip up a little bit better. Responding to Governor DeSantis in Florida, who basically, as he said in that clip at the start, I quarantined New York. He kept New Yorkers from coming into Florida when it was at its peak. And he was criticized for that. And yet that saved Florida in the month of April. That saved a lot of lives. So now there's a second wave. And you know where it's really bad, we're told? It's in Florida. And so here comes Governor Cuomo, of all people, to say that, hey, you've politicized this. You've politicized this. You've played politics with this virus, and you're losing. It's almost like they're gloating. It's spreading into the red states, and you deserve it because you lifted the lockdown. So New York has 31,373 deaths as of this morning. COVID-19 deaths in New York, 31,373. Florida, 3,329. It's 10 times worse in New York. It's more than that when you compare New York to Texas, 2,334 deaths. Oklahoma, I can add, 375. New York! 31,000. That the last person that should be appearing on TV to criticize Ron DeSantis is Andrew Cuomo. The hubris in some of these people, it is just, it staggers the mind. You see these articles about, well, I had one from a couple weeks ago, again, drawing attention to all the red states, but, you know, the blue states, they're just fine. And Andrew Cuomo, he handled this beautifully. Here is his brother yesterday praising the work that Andrew Cuomo has put in. Clip four.
I just hope you recognize what even I'm able to recognize, being spawned from the same wolf pack. I hope you are able to appreciate what you did in your state, and what it means for the rest of the country now, and what it will always mean to those who love and care about you the most. I'm wowed by what you did, and more importantly, I'm wowed by how you did it. This was very hard. I know it's not over, but obviously I love you as a brother. Obviously I'll never be objective. Obviously I think you're the best politician in the country. But I hope you feel good about what you did for your people, because I know they appreciate it.
31,373. And there's his brother saying, hey, New York, New Yorkers really appreciate what you've done. There was a CBS report yesterday saying that more than 54,000 people, this is nationwide, more than 54,000 people living or working in long-term care facilities, these are elderly care facilities, have died from COVID-19. That's over 40% of the total deaths in the United States. This has been, as you've heard on this show so many times, it's been a nursing home massacre. And in this CBS report, it talked about the decisions that have been made that have been utterly baffling. Why would you put people with COVID-19 into these elderly care centers. Making some of the same points that we've made weeks ago, months ago. And did you know in this CBS report, it didn't even mention Andrew Cuomo and that March 25 directive? You put those sick patients back into those elderly care centers. Just do it. I said to do it. I'm Andrew Cuomo. I'm the governor. Here comes CBS talking about how 50% almost, 40 to 50% of the total deaths nationwide have happened in these long-term care centers. And the report doesn't even mention Andrew Cuomo. He gets a complete pass. He's done it. He's handled it perfectly. There's his brother saying, I'm just wowed by what you've done. 31,373 deaths. That's just in New York, the state of New York. And judging by the CBS report yesterday, that means almost 15,000 of those deaths happened in elderly care centers. How much of that was caused by the directive, the March 25 decree that said, hey, we've got to empty out hospital beds, so if you've got a sick elderly patient, we're going to send them back to your center, and you've just got to provide for them. You've got to take care of them. You've got to quarantine them. You've got to find the facilities. They're not even hospitals, these places. And here are the hospitals of New York sending COVID-19 positives into elderly care centers. The nursing home massacre. Well, all of this scandalous behavior. If not for individuals like President Trump calling them out, what would we even hear about it? You remember the outgoing administration, Barack Obama and Joe Biden, of course, they were out there saying, yeah, scandal-free, 8 years, no scandals. And the media were right there saying, yeah, they didn't have one scandal. And then here comes President Trump. He's telling lies, hundreds of lies every day. Jim Jordan, you heard a clip from him earlier. He tweeted yesterday. These are some of the scandals from the Obama era. Fast and Furious, Solyndra, Benghazi, the IRS targeting conservative groups, Operation Choke Point, not familiar with that one, spying on journalists, the VA waiting lists, the cash payments made to Iran, all the Clinton emails. This happened during the Obama years. Unmasking political rivals. And we're not even to the Russia collusion hoax yet. And then Ukraine. All of these illegal investigations. Spying that continued right into the first few years of the Trump administration. President Trump was asked about this earlier this week, the spying and the investigation into his campaign and so on, brought on by Barack Obama. He's the one that ordered it. He's the one that ordered it on Flynn. Here's how the president responded earlier this week, clip 5.
You've been asked before about what crime he would have potentially committed, but I remember you talking to
treason.
That's treason.
Look. When I came out a long time ago, I said, they've been spying on my campaign. Mm-hmm. I said, they've been taping, and that was in quotes, meaning a modern day version of taping. It's all the same thing, but a modern day version. But they've been spying on my campaign. I told you that a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Turned out I was right. Let's see what happens to him now.
Let's see what happens now. He was right. Here he is calling it out again. Treason, that's what it is. It's an attack on the government of the United States of America. He said that about the BLM leader. That is treason. It's refreshing to hear. We don't hear it enough. Bill Barr, he was on Fox News, talking about the two standards of justice. under the Obama administration. Here's what he said. This goes back a few days ago, clip six.
Well, I do believe there were two standards of justice during a period of time toward the end of the Obama administration. And all I can do about it is apply one standard of justice, the right standard of justice, and make sure we apply it to everybody equally. And that's what I'm trying to do.
That's what he's trying to do. He said in this same interview that, well, I'll just play it, clip seven.
Well, first, I agree with you. It's been stunning that all we've gotten from the mainstream media is sort of bovine silence in the face of the complete collapse of the so-called Russiagate scandal, which they did all they could to sensationalize and drive. And it's like not even a whoops, they just on to the next false scandal. So that has been surprising to me, that people aren't concerned about civil liberties and in the integrity of our governmental process. In terms of the future of Durham's investigation, he's pressing ahead as hard as he can, and I expect that, you know, we will have some developments, hopefully before the end of the summer. But as I've said, his investigation will continue. It's not going to stop because of the election.
There he is in the early part of it saying, as far as the media goes, they don't even say, "Oh, I'm sorry, we got it wrong." They just move on. They dust off and move right on. But think about what was happening in that transition period. This is, I think, in the same interview. The interviewer asks about the Russia collusion story, and listen to this response from the Attorney General, clip 8.
Speaking of the Russia collusion story, that this was the closest the United States ever came to a coup to take down a president since the assassination of Lincoln. Is that an appropriate statement?
In this sense, I think it is the closest we have come to an organized effort to push a president out of office.
And it continues.
But what I'm not reaching a judgment as to what the motivations there were.
He qualifies it a bit there at the end, but it's the closest that we've come to an organized effort to push a president out of office. She calls it, the journalist there, she called it a coup. President Trump says it's treason. You can see why there's calls for impeaching William Barr now. They know what happened. Now, whether or not there's going to be justice in the end, again, it remains to be seen. But they see what's happened here. There's only a few that will stand up to it. We've been emphasizing the point of courage this week. And that it takes courage to stand up to the mob. Richard back at Edstone, he sent me this excerpt from a book called The Servile Mind. And it's talking about some of the history from World War I and the fighting spirit that you saw in Britain, in the United States. It says that war, with its terrible losses in the trenches, was set up as a legend of futility in which the casualties of the new trench warfare were referred to contemptuously by the butcher's metaphor of slaughter. It was a slaughter. And we can't have that happen again. We can't send our boys back to the trenches again. This book says it's by Kenneth Minogue. I don't know if I pronounced that right, but it says the soldiers were thus dehumanized. The longer-term result was to weaken British morale. It says recognition of the decline of British military prowess was a theme among the top brass of the military in World War II. It says, writing to General Wavell in 1940, Sir Alan Broke remarked, "We're not anything like as tough as we were in the last war. There has been far too much luxury, safety first, etc., in this country. Our one idea is to look after our comforts, avoid being hurt." Look after our comforts and avoid being hurt in any way. And it refers to Churchill, too, who was concerned about how quickly the British were surrendering in certain areas, even during the war. And we know about the appeasement that led up to it. Nobody wanted to go to war with Hitler. Nobody wanted to stand up to him. Nobody wanted to stand up to the tyrant, the villain. We were too afraid. We were too faint-hearted. And we very nearly lost the war once we finally started fighting. But here is this book, A Servile Mind. He's just talking about what has happened to our people over the past century or a little more. It says here, finally, a servile spirit had already been clearly apparent in the disposition to appease the Nazi government during the 1930s. That safety lies in surrendering one's interests. That safety lies in surrendering one's interest is the basic idea of appeasement, and it raises difficult questions of judgment because compromise is sometimes the rational and proper thing to do. To the servile mind, however, it is always the right thing to do. So he's saying at times, okay, there's a cause for compromise, but the servile mind thinks compromise all the time. That's always the solution. We don't want war, right? We don't want to lose. Think about this in the context of 2020. The mindset that we had at the peak level of COVID-19 or the rioting, the servile mind, it says, to the servile mind, it is always the right thing to do. Standing up for one's interests has costs, but they are as nothing compared with the cost resulting from an abnegation of courage. If you're going to stand up for your interests, there may be some costs. But what about the cost of surrender? What about the cost of appeasement? You can see why, as Christian soldiers, you can see why we need courage in times such as these. And God will back us. God will give us that courage if we go to him for it. This is from Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10 and verse 17. These are the disciples of Christ, and they're seeing what power they had at their disposal when God backed them. It says, and the 70 returned again with joy, saying, Lord, even the demons are subject unto us through your name. And he said to them, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. Verse 19, this is Luke 10. Behold, I give unto you power to tread on serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, it says, and nothing shall by any means hurt you. It says, notwithstanding in this, rejoice not that the spirits are subject to you, but rather rejoice because your names are written in heaven. You see, rejoice in the fact that you have God's power on your side. Rejoice in the fact that God will back you. God will empower you. God will give you courage. And we have so many examples that we can point to in the scriptures. I referred to several of them in the trumpet brief the other night. Richard reminded me of some history going back to the late 1970s, I think it was, when Stan Rader was interviewed by Mike Wallace on CBS, 60 Minutes, and it was a disaster. Mike Wallace, he basically pinned down Stan Rader, and Rader had to get up and leave. And Mr. Armstrong, I think he thought it was a bad idea to sit down with Mike Wallace in the first place. In any event, following that interview, Mr. Armstrong, he got his pen out, his typewriter, whatever, and wrote to the people in God's church and said, this represents an opportunity for us. And he started an ad campaign. He started to get the truth out there to a mass audience. Here, all of this negative attention, all of this negative publicity came on the church. And Mr. Armstrong was excited to stand up and to proclaim the truth. How different would that history have played out had he just walked away in shame or hidden out because, well, we don't want to take on the media. We don't want to get too bold. It's astounding, really, when you look at some of these examples. We have them in our own history. We had a local TV station come after us and attack us. And my father took the same approach. Full page ads. Well, maybe not full page. I think it was a quarter page ad in the Daily Oklahoman to get the truth out there. That's what you have to do. When the mob comes after you, you have to stand firm. You have to stand up. The president said earlier this week, stand for America. And of course, we in God's church stand up for God. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us all week, and we'll see you Monday.